The Institute.
Institute.
Institute for Justice.
The National Law Firm for Liberty.
Hello, and welcome to Short Circuit, your podcast on the Federal Courts of Appeals. I'm your host, Anthony Sanders, Director of the Center for Judicial Engagement at the Institute for Justice. We're recording this on Monday, November 29th, 2021. Please check out our newsletter by the same name and our other podcast, Bound by Oath. Well, we've had a lot of lawyers on Short Circuit over the years. After all, we are a legal podcast, even if we try to not speak in too much legalese when we're reading and discussing court opinions. But non-lawyers can read too, and sometimes even read those opinions. So I'm very happy to have on only our second non-lawyer ever to present a case, other than our original host, John Ross, who also is not a lawyer. I'd like to introduce Eric Boehm to everyone. Eric is a reporter for Reason Magazine, and his work has appeared in numerous other outlets. He reports on various subjects, including what he'll be talking about today, international trade policy, and he also is a huge town ball fan. Welcome, Eric.
Glad to be here, Anthony. Thanks for having me. I am clearly not worthy to be here, but I will do my best.
Well, as I told Eric before we started recording, the only other non-lawyer to present a case was Walter Olson, who only ran a legal blog for 20 years and has written numerous books on the subject. So,
as I said, totally not worthy.
You're in very good shoes here. That's a fill. He's here because he's recently wrote on a case before the Court of International Trade, which we're going to talk a little bit about, that gives us a window into trade policy and also how that policy gets translated into law. But for those who want a few more lawyers in the room, never fear. Also joining us is a familiar voice to Short Circuit listeners, Josh Windham of the Institute for Justice, who's going to tell us a little bit about a recent Pennsylvania Supreme Court case concerning state courts and standing. So welcome back, Josh.
Happy to be here.
So, Eric, we have a case here from the United States Court of International Trade. And I got excited when I saw this because I actually, when I was in private practice before at IJ, learned a little bit about this funny court, United States Court of International Trade. And the thing that I think a lot of people don't realize about it is it's actually an Article III court with, quote, real judges appointed by the president, confirmed by the Senate with life tenure. But they sit in New York, and really all they do is look at kind of tariff type stuff. Is that right?
Yeah, that's basically right. They look at trade issues and they adjudicate, you know, international trade disputes or customs disputes, tariff issues, things like that. As you said, this is an Article III court established under Article III of the U.S. Constitution, although the court maintains that its mandate also comes from Article I, Section 8 of the U.S. Constitution, which is important to the discussion we're going to have here today. That's the part of the Constitution that provides that all duties, imposts, and excises shall be uniform throughout the United States. That is the thing that says the federal government gets to set tariff rates, as opposed to like Connecticut having one rate of tariffs and Massachusetts having another one. But yeah, it's an Article III court. A couple of interesting things about it, because it is strange as federal courts go. It has a national jurisdiction, unlike I think every other federal court except the Supreme Court. So it doesn't have different districts or anything like that. There are 9 judges on the court, but under the statute that created the court, I'll talk a little bit more about that statute in just a second. But under that statute, no more than 5 of them can be from one political party, which is also something that, at least to my knowledge, again, not a lawyer here, but to my knowledge, I don't think that sort of restriction exists on any other federal court. Currently, there are actually only 7 judges on the court. There's 2 vacancies at the moment, 4 Obama-appointed judges and 3 Trump-appointed judges on the court. But you can have a 5-4 political majority, but you can't have any more than that. Which is interesting, I guess. There's also one that we should mention, one notable exception to the court's jurisdiction in cases that involve anti-dumping tariffs or countervailing duties. Those are two types of tariffs that the government can impose. That's most types of tariffs are one of those two things. Either one of those tariffs that are imposed on goods that are imported from Mexico or Canada, then the interested parties in that dispute can actually request that their case be heard by like a special ad hoc panel that is formed under the terms of the North American Free Trade Agreement, or now under the terms of the U.S.-Mexico-Canada Agreement, which is the new NAFTA that Trump put in place. And so that's sort of like agreeing to arbitration outside of court. And then this court, actually, their jurisdiction then doesn't apply to North American trade disputes under some circumstances. So, yeah, I mean, you summed it up pretty well. It's a strange court. It's a little bit odd. In its current form. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, and I was say, I think historically it used to be like a more an administrative, an Article I court. We sometimes, yeah. Us lawyers will say administrative court with administrative law judges. But then I believe in the 50s, it was made into an Article III court. And it's been reconstituted since then, but it's still basically the same thing. And I think the good lesson of that is that you can have, you know, trappings of what we call the administrative state, and dealing with you know, the regulations that the federal government puts out, but you can do it with Article III judges in a more constitutional manner, some of us might say. Even though you're dealing with more regulatory issues than you would normally, you know, today think of having before the government. So just because you're dealing with the administrative state doesn't mean that you can't have real judges that you're arguing in front of. So I think that's a good lesson that people keep in mind, that, you know, in this one case, for some reason, Congress thought, hey, we'll actually have some real judges.
Yeah.
But a lot of other stuff, they don't want to do that, like, you know, immigration or all kinds of other things.
And judges who have an expertise in a particular subject field, right? Which is, I think, important,
right,
when you deal with some of these obviously very convoluted trade issues, but sure, could apply to other policy issues too.
Well, and one other interesting thing is appeals from it go to the federal circuit, which is like the circuit we never talk about on Short Circuit, because most of what they have is like IP stuff that none of us understand. But there's a few other grab bag of jurisdictional issues that go up there under their jurisdiction, I should say. And this is one of them. So tell us what the latest is from the Court of International Trade on these tariffs that it seems that the new administration is quite fine to keep imposing.
Yeah, sure. So just one more quick thing about the court by way of background, because I think it's interesting to the way that tariff discussion is happening in Washington right now, is that to your point, the court actually goes back to the 1890s. Originally, there was a board of general appraisers, which was something that was within the U.S. Treasury Department. So it was actually part of the executive branch that had this sort of quasi-judicial authority over tariff disputes. And then in the 1920s, Congress replaced that with a different court. And then in the 1930s, they made that court fully independent of the Treasury, but not a full-fledged Article III court. And then finally, in the 1980s, you get to the point where this court, the U.S. Court of International Trade, is established as a full-fledged Article III court. So you've seen the jurisdiction here, or the dispute resolution mechanism for trade issues, has moved over the years from the executive branch, and it's become more and more independent, and then fully housed within the judicial branch. And at the same time that that's been going on, what you've seen is that Congress has been delegating more and more of its authority over the decades to the executive branch, because of course the Constitution gives Congress the final say on import and trade issues. But that's largely been delegated now over to the executive branch. And that was done in parallel to the court moving to the judicial branch. The Congress is giving those powers over to the presidency, largely with, I think, what is a smart thing to do, which is to say that the president will have the least strong urge to implement protectionist measures, because you have members of Congress. Every member of Congress represents a certain place in the country that has certain business interests that might want to keep out competition from foreign imports and foreign made goods. And so there's sort of an ongoing, and this was true for the first 100 years or more of U.S. history, there was sort of an always happening battle in Congress about setting tariffs or restricting imports and restricting trade to protect for political reasons. So by handing off a lot of that authority to the president during the 20th century, the idea there was that the president will take the larger view of things and will not be given to these sort of provincial protectionist urges. And that worked real well until President Donald Trump came along and decided that he was going to impose tariffs on a lot of different goods. One of the things that he did, and the issue that's at the root of this case that was just decided in front of the U.S. Court of International Trade, has to do with solar panel tariffs. So in January of 2018, just a few months before the more high-profile steel and aluminum tariffs, President Trump issued a proclamation that put tariffs on imported solar cells and modules, various components that go into making solar panels. As a matter of policy, these tariffs have been pretty bad. They've had negative impacts on just about the entire solar industry in the United States, from manufacturing to distribution to installation to finance, all the way up and down the chain. As a legal matter, though, Trump was pretty much entirely within his powers to do this because of this long history of delegating authority to the president to make tariff decisions. Specifically, he implemented these tariffs under Section 201 of the Trade Act of 1974. That gives the president wide authority to impose tariffs for what are explicitly protectionist reasons, written right into the law. It says that the president can put those duties in place to protect businesses that are threatened by similar products being imported from abroad. So in this case, there were two domestic solar panel companies that appealed to the Trump administration via the International Trade Commission for relief. Trump goes ahead, puts the tariffs in place. The tariffs were originally set at 30% in 2018, and then they were going to decline. They were going to decline to 25%, 20%, and then 15% in each of the next 3 years, and then they would fully expire in 2022. But in October of 2020, just prior to the election, Trump issued a new proclamation that changed two things. First, it closed a loophole in the original order, and it applied tariffs to a specific type of photovoltaic cell that had not previously been subject to these tariffs under the 2018 order. And then it also made changes so that instead of dropping from 20% to 15% this year in 2021, the tariff would only drop from 20% to 18% instead of 20 to 15 down to 20 to 18. And so that brings us to the case itself, which was Solar Energy Industries Association and some others versus the United States challenging under the Trade Act of 1974, challenging the president's authority to make those changes, not to impose the tariffs originally back in 2018, but to make the changes that Trump made in 2020, just prior to the election. And then on November 16th of this year, Judge Gary Katzmann at the U.S. Court of International Trade granted the Solar Industry Association's motion for summary judgment, and he dismissed the Biden administration's attempt to get the case dismissed. And as the summary judgment would suggest to you, this was a pretty open and shut case because the Trade Act of 1974, even though it does give presidents wide authority to impose tariffs, it specifically denies them the power to make changes to those tariffs once they are imposed for at least 3 years. There's a little bit of wiggle room in the law that would allow a president to withdraw tariffs that were imposed within a 3-year window, but they can't add to them, and they can't do what Trump did, which is make them worse. And this is this provision seems like it was pretty obviously put in place to prevent presidents from using tariffs as a sort of negotiating threat, which is exactly the thing that Trump wanted to use tariffs for over and over again. But the idea here is that Congress is saying to the president back in the 1970s, says, hey, look, you can have this authority to impose tariffs for these explicitly protectionist reasons, but we're not going to let you fiddle with it every 6 months, right? Because there's also a need there to provide some stability to the businesses that are affected by the new tariffs. So Trump's October 2020 proclamation, the one that made these pretty technical changes to the 2018 order, Judge Katzmann says those constituted both a clear misconstruction of the statute and action outside the president's delegated authority, and that neither the statute nor the statutory scheme supports interpreting Section 204 to permit increased restrictions on trade. And as a result, the changes that Trump ordered in October 2020 have to go, but those underlying 15% tariffs will remain in place. And I will just mention one last thing. I know I've probably talked too long. One last thing that's sort of funny, if we haven't put everybody to sleep yet, is that one of those two companies back in 2017 that had petitioned the Trump administration for these tariffs was a company called Suniva. based in Georgia. And it's really funny. If you look them up on Google, you go to their website, you will find the press section of their website. You will see that their most recent press release is from December of 2016, and it touts the successful expansion of their manufacturing plant in a suburb of Atlanta. That same plant was shut down just 3 months later. The company went into bankruptcy, and bankruptcy filings that were obtained by the Atlanta Business Chronicle found that the company had roughly 10 times as many liabilities as assets, and that it owed money to as many as 1,000 different creditors. So the company went through bankruptcy, exited bankruptcy, was purchased by a hedge fund a couple of years ago. They have still not produced a single solar panel in the time that these solar panel tariffs that they asked for, that were supposed to protect them from foreign competition, have been in place now for 4 years. They have not yet produced a single solar panel, and yet they are one of the two companies that is again petitioning the U.S. Trade Commission, petitioning now the Biden administration to extend these same tariffs once they expire in 2022, saying that they continue to need protection from foreign competition. So that's how this stuff works. It's just protectionism forever, and I guess we can at least give credit to the Court of International Trade for stopping one small part of it.
Wow. I was not aware of how our solar panel industry was structured. What I'm wondering, and maybe this is spelled out in the opinion, but it is, as you say, a very technical opinion, even for lawyers. The plaintiffs in this case who don't like this additional tariff that happened, they're domestic companies, but they use parts from abroad that are cheaper than like the parts that Georgia company wants to make. That's what's going on?
Sure. Yeah. These tariffs that were applied to not just finished solar panels, but to a lot of the components to the cells, the photovoltaic cells, which I'm not a scientist and I don't manufacture solar panels in addition to not being a lawyer. But my understanding is that those are literally the small components that you use and you put lots of them together to form a solar panel. Which is then, includes a lot of other pieces as well. And so even companies in this country that manufacture solar panels, and indeed many of the member companies of the Solar Energy Industries Association, which was the main plaintiff in this case, and they've been opposed to these tariffs since they were implemented. Even before they were implemented, they were arguing against them, or they were trying to convince the Trump administration not to put them in place. And they're now trying to argue against the extension of them that the Biden administration is considering. They represent a lot of companies that do business in the United States, that manufacture and sell solar panels in the United States. And their perspective on this is that these tariffs have been really just bad for the industry in general. It's also interesting, like politically, the way this cuts against the Biden administration's own agenda, right, on climate change. This gets probably a bit far afield of what we're talking about here. But if Biden wants more renewable energy used in the United States and curbing emissions and all of that, we want more solar panels in this country. It shouldn't matter where they come from. We just want to have more of them. And obviously, these tariffs are not helping the domestic industry, as the Suniva situation indicates. So all they're doing is making it more expensive for people and companies to buy the parts that they need to make and install solar panels here.
And how does this dispute relate to, the larger issue of the Trump tariffs on all kinds of stuff that Biden has basically, I think, kept it pretty much hook, line, and sinker, from the steel tariffs, all the tariffs against China? Is this just kind of like a loophole where Trump did something just a little off the books, and so that it was able to be challenged, but the rest of all these tariffs, there's nothing you can do unless the current administration changes course?
Yeah, and there have been other cases in front of this court. One that was brought by, I don't remember the exact name of the association, but it's an association of steel and metal industries in the United States that sued over the steel and aluminum tariffs when they first went into place a few years ago. And those have been allowed to stay in place, just like these, the underlying tariffs here. Even in this ruling, the underlying tariffs are allowed to stay in place because the president does have pretty wide authority to impose tariffs for any number of reasons. It was actually a whole different law that Trump used to impose the steel and aluminum tariffs. Those were under Section 232 of the Trade Expansion Act of 1960. So there's all sorts of different mechanisms that presidents can use, different levers they can reach for to impose tariffs. And the Biden administration has not really done much to withdraw the Trump tariffs, has mostly kept them in place. There was a little change to some of the tariffs involving steel and aluminum imported from Europe. They've replaced the tariff with a quota system, but that's just another form of trade restriction.
The challenge you were just referring to, was that the non-delegation challenge?
Oh,
that was
now
kind
you're
of
testing
a big.
I think that's correct.
That was kind of a big try.
Yeah, I think that's correct. That was the big heave there, was to try and undermine.
I think Public Citizen
idea.
Was involved in that.
They were involved in. Yeah, they were definitely involved in one of them. There were several lawsuits launched after those tariffs went in place. But to my knowledge, at least, I don't think any of them were successful.
I think the tariffs still exist.
So the president has pretty clear cut authority on this. Trump certainly expanded that authority, or expanded the understanding of what that authority entailed. And that, again, is better displayed by the steel and aluminum tariffs, which were imposed under this idea that that imported steel and imported aluminum somehow undermined national security. Because the president can impose tariffs to protect national security. And the argument that the Trump administration made there was that, if we don't protect our domestic steel and aluminum industries, we won't have the steel and aluminum that we need to build like fighter jets and tanks and bombs if we have to go to war,
Canada and Mexico.
Right. As if imports from Canada, if Canada is cutting off selling aluminum to us because we're going to war, we've got bigger problems than a lack of aluminum at that point. But the courts have upheld it, and Congress did very little. There were some noises made by some members of Congress about trying to restrict that authority under Trump, and that never really went anywhere and doesn't seem to be going anywhere now either.
It's not at all surprising, just if I could add this, that an act whose entire operation is founded on domestic companies petitioning the president to cripple their foreign competition is called the Trade Act, right? I mean, it's astonishing to see it. It's sort of a mockery. It really reminds me of, I'm sure listeners of the podcast have heard us talk about certificate of need laws. And like that itself too is a system designed to cripple competition, to suppress new entrants into the healthcare market, but it's, the title of those laws is certificate of need, right? So it's clothed in this sort of public interest, this sort of public rhetoric, but really what it's all about is crippling new entrants into a market. And imagine the incentives that it sets up, right? So here you've got a system where, these companies are spending hundreds of thousands of dollars competing in this entire bureaucracy set up to determine who gets to import at what prices, right? And in litigating about that. And at the end of the day, what's the result of this lawsuit? Well, these companies get a refund on the tariffs they paid, right? It's not like there's a net profit to the market from the results of these disputes in this bureaucracy. Imagine trying to run a business in this context. I mean, it must be so infuriating.
Well, it sounds like a lot of the business is petitioning the president to try and protect your business.
Right, right.
Yeah, no, I think that's exactly right.
Well, let's move from one funny court, the United States Court of International Trade, to another, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, which, although it may have a funny name, it has been around a very long time. In fact, if you look up the United States reports and you look at the very first page of the United States report, it is going to be a case from the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, not the United States Supreme Court. One of this latest cases sounds like the court is talking about guns. It's firearm owners against crime versus City of Harrisburg. But actually, it's not, at least at this point, it's not really, is it, Josh? So tell us a bit about it.
No, I mean, we'll see if the case ever gets to a point where it's about guns. Right now, the case is about standing, or at least the most recent, episode in this case is about standing. So to go back a bit, the case was filed in 2014. There was a group of gun owners who challenged a real bevy of City of Harrisburg ordinances from all sorts of different dates. I mean, one of them is from the 19th century, and they go up until like the latter part of the 20th century. So there's a bunch of different ones here, but the four main ones that I think are worth knowing about to understand this case are, and they're given these nicknames. So the first one is the Discharge Ordinance, which prohibits discharge of guns within the city, except in certain government-approved firing ranges. The second is a Parks Ordinance, which prohibits possession and discharge of firearms in city parks. The third is a Miners Ordinance, which prohibits unaccompanied minors from possessing guns outside residences in the city. So that would include like 17-year-olds. And a Lost / Stolen Ordinance, which requires reporting the loss or theft of a gun to police within 48 hours. Now, none of these all of these apply even if you've got a state, you know, license or concealed carry permit. So even if you have a lawful right to use or carry the gun, all these ordinances still apply. And they even apply if you're using the gun in self-defense. And so you have these owners who say, well, we think our Second Amendment rights and Pennsylvania constitutional right to keep and, you know, bear arms, those are being violated here. And they also think the ordinances are preempted by a state statute that prohibits local governments from regulating firearms in the ownership and possession of them, as long as they're for lawful purposes. So they, you know, they go to the city and they say, we think these are unconstitutional and preempted, and we'd like you to repeal them. And unsurprisingly, the city of Harrisburg says, nope, not going to do that. And in fact, the mayor, Pappenfuss, which is where part of the case name is Pappenfuss, the mayor says, no, these are really important ordinances, and we're going to keep enforcing them. The city police chief then says, yeah, we definitely cite people for this, and we're going to keep doing that. And so there's not really a question that these ordinances, you know, apply to people who, you know, want to use their guns and own guns legally, and that they're actively enforced. So after they refused their request by the city, you know, to repeal the ordinances, the gun owners go to court, Pennsylvania State Court, and they say, hey, you know, court, we'd like you to declare these ordinances unconstitutional and or preempted. And the mechanism they use is the State Declaratory Judgments Act, which is a really common tool that, you know, civil rights lawyers and public interest lawyers use to test the constitutionality of legislation that affects their clients. And the Declaratory Judgments Act, I think it's worth just kind of quoting from it here because it comes up later. It says that its purpose is remedial, and it says that that purpose is to settle and afford, quote, relief from uncertainty about rights, right? That's the language that's used in the act. And so the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, this case gets all the way up to the Pennsylvania Supreme Court. There's a question of, do the gun owners have standing to challenge the constitutionality of these ordinances? The trial court held they do not have standing because they were never cited, they were never threatened with enforcement, and the city kind of seized on that as saying, well, you're not really affected by these ordinances, right? There's never been any concrete enforcement against you. So how can you say that you're injured, right? How can you say that you're injured and have a right to bring this case? The Commonwealth Court, which is Pennsylvania's intermediate appellate court, reverses that. And then that reasoning is basically adopted by the Pennsylvania Supreme Court. So we can talk about what the Pennsylvania Supreme Court held. On appeal, the city, unsurprisingly, kind of latches onto the trial court's reasoning. It says, nope, no arrests, no citations. You haven't even changed your behavior based on this. And so, you know, any injury you might claim is speculative. The city even says that the public statements that the city had offered through its mayor and police chief were only generalized statements about enforcement. They were not telling specific plaintiffs that they would enforce against them specifically. And therefore, you know, they couldn't reasonably claim that they were going to be enforced against or threatened with enforcement. So what is this question of standing? Because it comes up a lot in public interest litigation and all sorts of other, you know, other contexts. And the idea in federal courts is that in order to have what's called an Article III case or controversy, you have to have standing, which means you have to have injury, causation, and redressability. And federal courts, you know, apply this pretty strictly. It's basically the way you get into federal court is show that you have standing by meeting these three requirements. And it's a constitutional requirement to get into federal court. But as the Pennsylvania Supreme Court notes here, and as Justice Wecht, in his concurring opinion, which we can talk about in a bit, emphasizes, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court is not a federal court. They're not bound by federal standing requirements. Any standing limitations they have are self-imposed. They're prudential. And so they're really kind of guideposts for what cases are appropriate for resolution and what cases kind of fall into this category of an impermissible advisory opinion, which is something courts don't.
Yeah, and Josh, so they don't really go into it, but it sounds, and I haven't checked it out, but it sounds like the Pennsylvania Constitution, it doesn't have case or controversy language, and it just kind of refers to the courts having judicial powers. And so that's why they don't think there's a constitutional limitation on them.
That's right. Yeah. And I want to circle, please remind me to circle back to this in a second, because there is something in the Pennsylvania Constitution that is important to this analysis, I think. But instead of the injury causation redressability trifecta that federal courts apply, Pennsylvania courts apply something that's a bit more relaxed. They require that you be, quote, aggrieved by the action or statute that you're challenging, which they construe to require a substantial interest that is both direct and immediate. Now, that stuff at the end of the day kind of amounts to the injury causation and redressability requirements, but you could think of it as a more relaxed version of that. And the Pennsylvania Supreme Court ultimately holds, well, there's a substantial interest here because there are gun owners who want to exercise their rights to use guns lawfully. That's not de minimis. There's a direct impact on their right to use those guns because the challenged ordinances, you know, directly apply to that right and to their right, right? Not the rights of somebody else, but the rights of the people before the court. And the impact is immediate because the ordinances apply and the people who are subject to them, the plaintiffs, have to choose now in this moment whether to comply with them or whether to willfully disobey the law and risk, you know, possible criminal penalties for that. And the court also clarifies, and I think this is really helpful, and it's a good thing for Pennsylvania that it's doing this, that there's no requirement here that you suffer direct enforcement or threats of enforcement to seek a declaratory judgment. And that's because of what I was talking about earlier. The Declaratory Judgments Act has this language that says we have to construe it liberally to give people the relief they need from the uncertainty that laws impose on their rights. So you would think this is a relatively straightforward decision. I mean, lots of courts across the country hold that you could seek pre-enforcement review of statutes that allegedly affect your constitutional rights, especially in state courts. It's happened in IJ cases a bunch. But there's some interesting, it's interesting that it's a 4-3 decision, right? It wasn't a clear-cut decision. It was hotly contested. And I want to talk about a couple of the other opinions here. So Justice Wecht, who concurs with the majority opinion, has 3 points that I think are really interesting. So he wholeheartedly embraces the majority's reasoning, but he has some interesting color to add to it. So he says, first of all, you know, you don't have to. I actually just want to read what he says because it's pretty good. He says, we don't require citizens to become lawbreakers in order to bring such challenges, nor do we require citizens quietly to abdicate their individual rights and submit to legislation that they believe violates those rights. This is true whenever government enactments force the choice between forfeiting one's rights or complying with the law. And then he talks about how that's true not just of Second Amendment rights, but of all constitutional rights. So he's clearly extrapolating here from a right that maybe he doesn't personally favor so much to all sorts of other contexts, right? ACLU filed a brief in this case supporting the gun owners here and their perspective on standing. So that's a good take by Justice Wecht. But he goes on to say, and this is, I think, really interesting, Anthony, because you were getting at the state constitution. He says that he reads the Declaratory Judgments Act in Pennsylvania as implementing the state constitutional guarantee to a remedy in court, which you find in Article 1, Section 11 of the Pennsylvania Constitution, that in fact, the Declaratory Judgments Act is just a way to implement the constitutional guarantee that when you're injured, you have a right to a remedy in state court. I think that's really interesting. It's an argument we've made at IJ before, and it's really cool to see a state high court justice saying it. And then finally, and I mentioned this earlier, he emphasizes, look, we are not a federal court. At the end of the day, that might be helpful guidance for us, what federal courts say about standing, but we can do whatever we want here, effectively, which is true. And then just the final word on what the dissenters thought, because I thought it was interesting that there were 3 dissenters, and it could be because of the politically charged nature of this case, but the main argument that the dissenters raise is that, well, there are no allegations in the complaint that the gun owners have violated or intend to violate the ordinances, and therefore they can't have a concrete stake in the controversy, right? Just as gun owners in the abstract. And the dissenters point to the fact that in 2014, when the case was filed, there was this law in effect that granted standing to anyone who was a gun owner to challenge these kinds of restrictions on their, you know, right to own and use firearms. And so it could have been that when they were drafting their complaint, they thought they didn't have to prove as much of an injury in order to, you know, get into court. Now, the following year, that statute was declared unconstitutional by the Pennsylvania Supreme Court on other grounds. And so they never amended their complaint. And the dissenters say, look, you should have just amended your complaint and we wouldn't even be talking about this, right? But you didn't do that. Now, I don't think I buy the dissenters' argument here. And I want to point out why. There's a footnote where they quote, quote the allegation in the complaint that they take to be deficient. And they say, appellees aver, and this is the allegation, quote, that they own, possess, use, and bear firearms for all lawful purposes, including but not limited to self-defense, hunting, firearms, education slash training, and target shooting. I mean, it seems to me that if you have firearms and you intend to use them for all lawful purposes consistent with your state right to do that, and that would conflict at any point with the ordinances and what they prohibit, at that point you've alleged a concrete stake in you know, your compliance or non-compliance with the ordinances. So I don't think that I buy what the dissenters are arguing here. But in any case, the court rules 4-3 that gun owners have standing to bring a pre-enforcement challenge to these ordinances.
Yeah, one thing about these ordinances that probably didn't help, you know, why there were three votes, because I would think there shouldn't be any in the dissent, maybe even in federal court, to tell you the truth, for this type of challenge, is that it doesn't seem like they're type of ordinances that they're going to be breaking, like no discharge other than at a firing range. You know, unless you're actually working in self-defense, you wouldn't think that would even come up. And I'm guessing they didn't have any, you know, specific averments that they're going to be doing something like that. And then this ordinance about not possessing a firearm in a public park?
Yeah, you can't carry one in a public park.
Right. I mean, that one's more straightforward and kind of raises my eyebrow why you couldn't challenge that. But I think there's a little bit of that going on. But yeah, overall, you're right, Josh. This is a great lesson for state standing versus standing in federal court. A lot of states have just gone along with what Article III courts have said about what standing is without really pointing to anything in the state constitution or state statutes. There are even some states that say, well, we have essentially the same thing as Article III standing, unless the legislature, you know, gives you a cause of action. And then you can have something where it's, you know, taxpayer standing or something like that, which makes you wonder, well, why are you limited that way in the first place if there's no statute that says you can't do that? And a lot of that, I think, is just never – it's almost like a common law thing. It's just never been worked out by the state courts in that way.
Yeah, and if I could add one thing. I mean, I think Justice Wecht actually – I mean, I like the majority's analysis here, but I think Justice Wecht really keying on to the fact that the – like to put it in federal terms, because it seems like the dispute really was over whether there was a concrete injury, right, whether you could identify what the harm was that would made these appropriate plaintiffs, right, to get into court. And Justice Wecht does a really good job of saying the injury, if you want to use that term, is forcing someone to make a choice between exercising what they take to be their constitutional rights and willfully violating the law. Like that choice is the injury, right? Not the future enforcement that you might get if you violate the law. You shouldn't put citizens in a position of having to choose whether to violate the law just to vindicate their constitutional rights. And he even says at one point, and this came up in one of our cases actually, and I can explain that in a second, but he even says at one point that, quote, nor does the individual have to face economic hardship or professional disaster, unquote, to have standing. And that to me reminds me of a case that, you know, we're still litigating actually, but it's our property management case here in Pennsylvania where we've got a vacation property manager who's being told by the state of Pennsylvania, you have to get a full-on real estate broker's license to manage effectively Airbnb properties for your neighbors, which requires, you know, spending over 3 years apprenticing and taking courses and exams and doing all sorts of things like that to get your license. And, you know, her argument at the outset was, this is really burdensome on me just to do the kind of de minimis work that I'm doing for my neighbors. And the state said, well, you don't have standing, right? Or the case isn't ripe. They made both those arguments, which are kind of sides of the same coin. You don't have standing and the case isn't ripe because you've never been cited and you didn't even apply for a license. And our response to that was like, well, you know, right now, the state's position is that what she's doing by working without a license is illegal. So she has to stop working, lose all of that income, and then spend 3 years of her life applying for this license. Like, that there is the injury. The fact that she's got to stop what she's doing and spend the 3 years doing it, not the fact that she doesn't have the license, right? And the Commonwealth Court ultimately holds, applying really similar reasoning to what I just read to you from Justice Wecht, that somebody doesn't have to suffer all of those economic burdens just to challenge the thing that is causing the burden.
Josh, I saw, I'll make the dreaded comment and a question, I guess. I saw, it's interesting to me that the Pennsylvania Supreme Court is like a 5-2 Democrat majority at the moment. So, I mean, it's interesting to see a gun owner's case, I guess, break down the way it did. And that's, you know, in a positive way, right? Like, it's good to see that that's not just a hot political topic that is breaking right down on party lines when the judges get it. But since you mentioned the economic standing issue, the economic issue there, economic harm, I saw a comment in some of the news coverage from this from Eric Papenfuss, the mayor of Harrisburg. And he said this is a, you know, it's a bad decision because what this means is that cities are going to be vulnerable to all sorts of lawsuits on other issues along these same lines, not just from gun owners over gun laws. And, you know, I think maybe that's a good thing. Maybe more cities should face lawsuits if they are passing laws that are similar to this, but in different ways. Like, do you read this ruling that way too? Like, does this open up other avenues in Pennsylvania for litigation against, you know, yeah, for example, your Airbnb owners or any other thing that a city might do that restricts somebody's behavior, even if they're not actually enforcing it?
I think it does less of opening the floodgates and more of making it clear that the government needs to stop making these arguments in court, because what the court in the case does in the majority opinion is it cites case after case after case where plaintiffs have brought pre-enforcement challenges to statutes or advisory opinions, or I'm sorry, administrative opinions or regulations restricting their rights in various ways or imposing duties on them in various ways before there was a concrete threat of enforcement. And look, I mean, pre-enforcement challenges are just a routine part of civil rights litigation. And the government, knowing that probably full well, continues to make these kind of kitchen sink arguments that you have to be, you know, basically punched in the face by the government before you can complain about the fact that they've got a fist, you know, held up over you.
I sometimes think it must be in your employment contract if you are a state's attorney that you need to raise standing in every single civil rights case. So I'm always shocked when it isn't raised by a city or state attorney.
Me too. And when I was reading through the majority opinion, I mean, there's a bunch of cases quoted. The Pennsylvania Supreme Court has this tradition, and I don't see it tons in other state Supreme Courts, but of like meticulously going through and reciting the major points from both sides before they get to the substance of their opinion. So they say the city argues this, this, and this, right? The appellants argue this, this, and this. And the city made several points that were just like, you could copy and paste those from the government's briefs in our case from a couple of years ago where they make the same standing arguments. So it's, these arguments aren't going away, but hopefully decisions like these will continue to clarify that they're more and more frivolous over time.
And the problem is they, sure, if you appeal, you usually eventually will prevail, but there's going to be a busy trial court judge who doesn't have a lot of these cases and is going to see the argument raised in a government brief and is going to grant it. And it's going to waste everybody's time instead of looking to a case like this. And so the more cases like this there are, I guess the less likely that is to happen.
Yeah, that's 1,000% true. And like one of the government gets two things out of making these arguments. One of the things they get is that maybe the trial court bites or something like that and the case gets dismissed, which is, you know, its own value to them. But the other thing is that this case was filed in 2014 and we just got a decision in October 2021 that the gun owners have standing. Like standing.
On to the merits.
Yeah, exactly.
7 years later.
Right. So this case, you know, I'm sure it'll get back up to the state Supreme Court. And so we'll have a decision in, you know, 2031. From a case filed in 2014 about whether these ordinances, one of which was passed in like 1890, is constitutional or not.
Well, it's funny that you mention 2014 because this podcast began in 2015. And in a little preview here, in a couple episodes, we will be having a retrospective on how Short Circuit began and what has happened since then. So you guys should stick around for that episode. This will be episode 200. We're at episode 198. But episode 198 has been a lot of fun. Thank you so much, Eric, for coming on and giving us your non-lawyer trade expertise.
Thanks so much, Anthony. Glad to do it.
And Josh, as always, your Pennsylvanian expertise. You're becoming quite the expert on the ways of that court. To everyone else, I hope you had a happy Thanksgiving and having now a festive holiday season. And when you're being festive in that holiday season, I want all of you to get engaged.